looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school. In the summer of 1982, one evening that summer, after a day of diving at the club, I attended a small gathering at a house in the Bethesda area. There were four boys I remember specifically being at the house.
Dr. Ford may have been sexually assaulted by some person in some place at some time. But I have never done this to her or to anyone. That's not who I am. It is not who I was. I am innocent of this charge.
That is the accuser and the accused speaking at the 2018 confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. It was a perfect storm coming right there in the middle of the outbreak of the Me Too movement. It was political theater. It was, well, for a lot of people, a political battle because, of course, the next justice on the Supreme Court was hanging in the balance. It was a personal battle for everyone involved. And there's a lot more to the story than we generally know or was generally reported. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Tuesday afternoon, the 23rd of July. Joining us to talk about the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, Molly Hemingway, a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and co-author of the new book, Justice on Trial. Molly, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It is great to be here with you.
Near the end of the book, you write, "Make no mistake, the smear campaigns against judicial nominees are themselves an attack on the court's legitimacy." What do you mean by that?
We wrote Justice on Trial to tell the story of the Kavanaugh confirmation, but we also wrote it to talk about the Supreme Court's legitimacy and various attacks on it. Some of those attacks are very direct, and some of them are indirect. It is important that the court be viewed as the important tribunal that it is. And when you attack a nominee or you attack a sitting justice on the court, you're trying to suggest that the court's decisions are illegitimate. The battle for the Supreme Court is not just about individual nominees, but about the very direction of the court. And there has been this big dispute between people on the left who think that the court should be shaping policy issues, particularly when the people aren't making those decisions themselves, and people on the right who think that the court has a fairly simple job, which is simply to establish whether a law is constitutional or not. And when you can't win the actual nomination battles or, you know, win the presidential elections by which people are nominated, some people choose to just go after particular justices or otherwise.
So this story, with that frame around it, really begins a long time ago with a nominee, Robert Bork, and a little later, a nominee who would eventually become Justice Clarence Thomas. How do those lay the groundwork for the Kavanaugh hearings?
Right. Well, I think when the Kavanaugh drama happened, a lot of people might have thought it was unprecedented, but people who remembered their fairly recent history could see that some of what was going on was quite similar to what happened to Justice Thomas during his confirmation battle, but also Robert Bork. And we actually take it back even one step further, which is a lot of what was used against Robert Bork successfully to scuttle his nomination was also used against the elevation of Justice Rehnquist to Chief Justice, including that Ted Kennedy's famous speech against Bork, this is the one where he said that apocalyptic things would happen if Bork were confirmed to the Supreme Court. He had done an almost identical speech about Rehnquist. That is the era when people start organizing to stop Republican nominees. Prior to that point, there had been occasional unrest about a nominee or there had been hearings or something, but with Rehnquist and then Bork, that's when you start seeing actual groups organizing together, running television ads, which had never been done prior to that, working to really shape public opinion around a nominee. And again, this all relates to an idea of whether the court has a fairly simple job or whether it is the means by which you should force changes in the law over and against the will of the people. And with Justice Thomas, it was an almost identical situation to what happened with Kavanaugh. I think people who knew that history were much less surprised by what happened with Kavanaugh. Justice Thomas, before he's justice, he goes through his first set of hearings. It's all expected that he's going to be confirmed. And then there's a last-minute allegation without evidence to suggest that he's unfit for the court. And it was a very brutal period of time for him to get through, but he actually not only was confirmed, he's the only sitting Supreme Court justice to be confirmed by a Senate of the opposing party from the nominator, the president.
So in researching and real-time reporting on the Kavanaugh hearings, what did you learn that was not being widely reported at the time or since? I imagine that's might be a long list of things.
There is. So my co-author, Carrie Severino, and I were very involved in the confirmation process. I was covering it throughout the whole period of time. She was actually working on the confirmation in support of Kavanaugh. So we thought we knew everything. In fact, that's why we wanted to write the book. We thought, this is such a good story. We have all these details that would make for a good story. We had no idea how much we didn't know. And we interviewed more than 100 people, including the president, vice president, Supreme Court justices, members of the Senate, people close to the Kavanaugh family, people close to the Blasey family, and we were just thrilled to learn so many new things, whether it was getting the never-before-published details about how Justice Anthony Kennedy secretly leaves the Supreme Court in order to tell President Trump that he is retiring and makes it back to the Supreme Court without anybody at the White House or the Supreme Court noticing, how the Kavanaugh family felt about going through the process, or the things that I think were underreported, you know, because those are things you might not expect to be reported, would include the coordination on the left in the campaign, the flying in of protesters, the paying of their bail, the coordination of their messages, the Democratic senators working with Christine Blasey Ford to create the right visual cues to evoke the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearings, that type of stuff, which we lay out in great detail, but also learning about Leland Kaiser, who was the longtime friend of Christine Blasey Ford's, childhood friend, but still a friend, who is named as one of the witnesses to the alleged assault. And when she first finds out that she's named as a witness, she just feels horrible, like she let down her friend years ago by not knowing that this happened. She's trying to come up with anything to remember or corroborate the story for her friend, but she's unable to do so, at which point she starts getting pressure from some mutual friends to change her story. And even though she's a lifelong liberal who does not want Brett Kavanaugh confirmed to the Supreme Court, she's also someone who cares a great deal about telling the truth, and she's in recovery, so it's actually an important matter for her to always tell the truth. And she does tell the truth, even under pressure, and ends up spending time really trying to reconstruct that summer to see if there's anything. And she remembers the summer quite well. It was a very formative summer for her. It's when she started golfing, which is her life's passion. And she actually comes to lose confidence in her friend's story. And she tells the FBI that and about the pressure she received. And that ends up being very important for senators who are trying to make a decision about whether there's anything to this claim that Brett Kavanaugh assaulted someone.
How would you evaluate the media's treatment of the story? What kind of grade would you give them?
If there were, I would say it has to be worse than an F. It's not a failure of not doing work. There was something fraudulent about what was going on for too many people. They were hiding or suppressing stories that they knew to be true, elevating things that they had reason to be skeptical of. There were stories that never should have been written about allegations against Kavanaugh, but it was their overall tone that was so bad, too. But we do go through quite a few very specific examples of media malpractice, whether it's NBC News knowing that the supposed witness to Julie Swetnick's outlandish, claims about serial gang rape whether, you know, they knew that that supposed second witness was denying what Attorney Michael Avenatti was claiming she would say, and they just sat on it for weeks. They knew it before the confirmation vote, but they didn't say anything until weeks later. That is not in any way defensible.
What kind of safeguards can the media take to avoid not only the mistakes, but it sounds like the misdeeds like those in the future?
I do think it might be naive at this point, after decades of thoughtful, reasonable criticism of the media, to think that these are mistakes. I think it's probably wiser to assume that this is sort of built into the process, that frequently what happens with far too many people in political media is they take sides and then they let their journalism follow from that, rather than trying to tell a story honestly or accurately. So I think what's more important probably is that people not assume that these are mistakes, that they start thinking about whether there should be repercussions for taking part in, for instance, a campaign to destroy someone with a very good reputation, to destroy his life and his reputation in front of his wife, kids, parents, and the entire world. The media themselves, they gave each other awards for how they covered the Kavanaugh confirmation trial, and there is really no defense of that at all.
You had mentioned Michael Avenatti, who did you guys a big favor shortly after the book came out by whining on Twitter. I think he called the book trash or garbage or something like that. Because you had not interviewed him, what was his role in all of this?
Right. He actually had a pretty important role in the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, or so we were told by our sources. So the first allegation against Kavanaugh is remarkable because it's a very vague allegation. It's almost impossible to either confirm or deny. There are almost no specifics, and the specifics that are there are not anything that you can dig into. It's at least possible that it happened, even though there's no evidence that the woman making the accusation has ever met Brett Kavanaugh. The second allegation is weird. The New Yorker puts it out. Jane Mayer of The New Yorker puts out an allegation of a woman who spends 6 days with Democratic-appointed attorney to create a memory of Brett Kavanaugh, possibly, but possibly not, being in a room where someone exposed himself to her, but she was really drunk, so she doesn't really remember. I mean, it never should have seen the light of day. Many people, including The New York Times, which is not really a great publication itself at times, said they interviewed dozens of people. Nobody knew what she was talking about. The third allegation is Michael Avenatti's, which is that Brett Kavanaugh was the secret leader of a serial gang rape cartel roaming suburban Maryland. By the time that that allegation comes out, everybody realizes, oh, this isn't real. We're not actually dealing with a federal judge who led a secret life, who made it through six background checks undetected, but really was doing all this horrible stuff. We're dealing with a campaign to destroy him. And so one of our sources said that there were three people who were responsible for Kavanaugh being confirmed, three or four people, and that Michael Avenatti was definitely one of them. He took it from the realm of plausible to already we're starting to be a little suspicious to just this is ridiculous.
Molly Hemingway is our guest. She's co-author of the new book, Justice on Trial. We're talking about the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. We'll go back to the beginning of the story and Justice Anthony Kennedy's covert visit to the White House.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. Eighth century. The fourth century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc. Faith Lutheran Church and School in Plano, Texas preaches Christ crucified. Join us each Lord's Day to hear law and gospel preaching and to receive the Lord's Supper. Our classical preschool through grade 12 Lutheran school is second to none. The school serves home educators, too, with online classes in the high school. We are located at 1701 East Park Boulevard in Plano, Texas. Reach us by phone at 972-423-7448 or on the web at www.flsplano.org.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Tuesday afternoon, we're talking about the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings with Molly Hemingway. She's a regular guest, a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and co-author of the new book, Justice on Trial. Molly, let's go back to where this particular story begins, and that's with something you mentioned before, a covert visit by Justice Anthony Kennedy to the White House.
Yeah, this is not necessarily how Supreme Court justices typically retire. And I loved learning this story because we weren't even looking for it, but by interviewing a bunch of different people, we slowly pieced together what happens. A lot of people had suspected he might retire. Certainly the White House had been kind of trying to make him feel comfortable with retirement. They were listening to his views on which of his former clerks were good. Neil Gorsuch was one of his star former clerks. They put Brett Kavanaugh on the list of potential nominees, also a star former clerk. And they were actually naming a bunch of other former clerks to federal judgeships. They were being respectful of him. They kind of signaled that to him. But at the end of the term, that's usually when a retirement is announced, and nothing is announced. So the big news last year was, well, I guess Anthony Kennedy isn't retiring. But he had secretly laid the groundwork a couple days earlier by talking with a former clerk of hers who works for the Trump administration, basically says to him, I'm thinking I might retire, and I would like to tell the president before it goes public if I do. So could you just see how we would do that? And they, without, you know, nobody actually knows for sure what's going to happen, but they arranged to have a car secretly leave the White House, get into the underground parking garage at the Supreme Court. He leaves after the end of that term. He does tell his fellow justices that he is retiring. They're shocked, by the way, because he'd already been making plans for the next year. But he says, please don't say anything until I can tell the president. So he gets out, goes to the White House. They have a meeting. And the thing that I think people might not expect is they actually get along, Anthony Kennedy and Donald Trump, who are two very different people, but they kind of have this affinity for each other. They have a nice, cordial chat, and then he gets back in the car, leaves the White House, and gets back to the Supreme Court before the news breaks. And, you know, there are press all over the White House, and it's just really remarkable that that happened without him being discovered there or by anybody at the Supreme Court, and yet it did.
What was Brett Kavanaugh's history before becoming a household name during the nominations and the confirmation hearings?
Well, he actually was a fairly well-known person in the legal community. He's been named as the next likely Republican nominee to the Supreme Court since 2012. So he's kind of well-known in that way. He'd been a federal judge for 12 years. He worked for President George W. Bush, both in the White House counsel and as staff secretary. And he also worked on the Whitewater investigation of the Clintons for Ken Starr. So he was pretty well known in the D.C. area, and he grew up here, which is where I am too. So he had a solid reputation. He was considered a likely pick for the Supreme Court, but he really had cultivated decades of a good reputation, and I think it ended up being very helpful to him. When allegations start coming out, he has friends just coming out of the woodwork to defend him, and we interviewed some of the people who had known him, and I remember this one woman telling us that there are maybe five, possibly only one man in the world that she would defend, and Brett Kavanaugh was that person. He really seemed to have good, loyal friendships built up over decades, and it ends up being a godsend once the allegations come.
So what
were the origins of those allegations? What did you discover?
Well, it was interesting to learn a little bit more about the first allegation, which comes from Christine Blasey Ford, who also grew up in the D.C. area. As soon as Kennedy retires, she starts reaching out to friends to say that she really hopes it's not Kavanaugh because he tried to rape her when they were in high school. The news hits a lot of people by surprise. She had sometimes talked about an assault with varying degrees of specificity, but here she's now putting a name with him. Now, one of the things she claims in her letter that she sends to Anna Eshoo and also Dianne Feinstein is that she wants to do this very secretly. So it's curious that one of the very first calls she makes is to the Washington Post tip line. And even when they don't respond right away, she kind of says, well, should I call the New York Times? So she has this combination of publicly talking about how she wants to keep her name out of it while also immediately soliciting media interest in her story. She does write a note to Dianne Feinstein. There is a process in the Senate for such notes. This was one of the things I was surprised to learn, is that allegations, you know, either solid allegations or completely invented allegations, are a common part of the nomination process. And to protect everyone involved, there is a well-established, long-established process for handling them. Dianne Feinstein avoids that process, circumvents the process, doesn't put the letter into that process, doesn't ask Brett Kavanaugh about it in the confidential meeting that she and other senators have with him precisely for things like this. She doesn't even show up to that meeting, in fact. Instead, she connects Christine Blasey Ford with a Democratic attorney who has a reputation for handling high-profile sexual assault allegations against top-level people. Those people also, you know, they don't go through the normal process. They arrange a polygraph test, a very interesting, somewhat curious polygraph test. And then, of course, somehow, we don't know exactly how, there's a very limited pool of people who have access to the letter, but somehow there then occurs a very well-orchestrated PR drop of the information. There are a couple stories that raise anticipation about it, one of them by Jane Mayer and Ronan Farrow at The New Yorker, and another by The Intercept, that kind of builds bubbling anticipation. And then The Washington Post writes this really very friendly account of what happened, leaving out problems with Christine Blasey Ford's story, which had changed quite a bit over time, and covering up various details, too. So that's kind of how everything gets going. And, of course, from that moment on, an already chaotic nomination process gets just crazier.
What were the problems with Ford's story?
Well, I would say, first and foremost, there just was no evidence to support it. So people say, oh, do you believe her? Do you believe him? And the proper approach when someone makes an allegation is to not instinctively or defensively believe one person or the other, but to evaluate the evidence. And there simply was never any evidence to support that they even met, much less that there had been an assault. The Washington Post makes it sound like it's a credible allegation because she had talked to a therapist about it. But the therapist notes, of which they are not given full access but partial access, actually have like a different set of facts, that four boys attacked her. By the time it's in the Washington Post, it's one boy attacking her, one boy looking on, and two other boys in the house, and also a girl. But they hide the fact that it's a girl, even though we know that the Washington Post knew that Leland Kaiser was one of the alleged witnesses, because the reporter is asking one of the other alleged witnesses about her being there. So it was just something that kind of, she didn't know where it happened, how she got there, how she got home, why or whether she left her friend there in the house where sexual assault was allegedly happening. So some people found the story very credible despite the holes in it or the lack of evidence in support of it. Other people thought they themselves have been victims of sexual assault, or they know other people who've been victims of sexual assault, and it was a very curious lack of detail. Rachel Mitchell, the sex crimes prosecutor who's hired by Republicans to ask questions, ends up pulling some of these threads in her questioning of Christine Blasey Ford in that reopened Senate hearing.
So did Justice Kavanaugh's, then nominee Kavanaugh's, story ever waver in his response to those accusations?
So this was another interesting thing. When they first heard the allegations, people who were on his team were kind of anxious to hear what he had to say. They wanted to know, is he going to say, oh my goodness, like, I dated her, but we never, you know, I never attacked her, or that was a complete misunderstanding of what happened. Instead, from the moment he hears anything about it, he says decisively, this never happened. That really strikes his team because they had been frustrated by the way he'd answered questions during the first round of hearings where he was so careful to not perjure himself in any way. So if someone said, have you ever spoken to someone at this law firm? You know, he wouldn't say no. He would say, I'd have to know who was at that law firm and what time are you talking about? You know, and instead of just dismissing the question, he was very careful. So when he comes out and just says definitively, this didn't happen and I want to clear my name, they are very taken by that because they know how careful and precise he is about everything, almost to the point of frustration. But it also makes it an issue for senators. We spoke with senators who said the mere allegation itself would not have been sufficient to not vote for him because they felt like it was kind of a weird allegation. Going back to high school, it could have been confusion about memories or something like that. But when he denies it, all of a sudden the stakes are much higher because if there is any truth to it, they would vote against him because that would mean that he had been lying, and lying is not something you can tolerate for a sitting Supreme Court justice. So it was interesting to see how different senators responded to his response.
We're talking about the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. Molly Hemingway is our guest, a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist and co-author of the new book, Justice on Trial. Be sure to purchase Justice on Trial using the Amazon link under the on-demand archives page at issuesetc.org. On the other side of the break, what was happening behind the scenes? The kind of stuff that, well, only the real insiders, the senators and their aides, got to witness. Stay tuned.
Jesus never takes volunteers. Rather, he is the one who initiates discipleship.
Dr. John Pless, author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for July, Luther's Small Catechism, A Manual for Discipleship.
Jesus is the one who confiscates the lives of those that he chooses through his word and makes of them disciples.
Learn more about this new resource, Luther's Small Catechism, A Manual for Discipleship, at issuesetc.org.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans in their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
Discover a truly Lutheran approach to education. Concordia University Chicago's Center for the Advancement of Lutheran Liberal Arts supports a vibrant, growing community of classical educators. Whether you're a teacher, administrator, parent, or homeschooler, we have the resources and contacts you need to start a child's journey into the Lutheran Liberal Arts. Visit cuchicago.edu/cala. That's C-A-L-L-A.
For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. We may be months away from Christmas, but we're right in the middle of Emmanuel Press's Christmas in July sale. Our one-of-a-kind, Christ-focused Christmas cards and a variety of books are on sale through the end of the month. Visit us at emmanuelpress.us for more details about our Christmas in July sale. EMMANUEL Press.US. EmmanuelPress.US.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Lutheran Talk.
In Lutheranism, I come as a guilty sinner in need of hearing the forgiving words of Christ every single time I gather. Every single time.
Lutheran Music. The new Lutheran Public Radio app. Download for iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.
Do solemnly swear.
I, Brett M. Kavanaugh, do solemnly swear
that I will administer justice without respect to persons.
That I will administer justice without respect to persons.
And do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
And do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
And that I will faithfully and impartially.
And that I will faithfully and impartially
discharge and perform.
Discharge and perform.
All the duties incumbent upon me.
All the duties incumbent upon me.
As Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
As Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Under the Constitution and laws of the United States.
Under the Constitution and laws of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
That's Brett Kavanaugh being sworn in as the 114th Supreme Court Justice in a ceremony on October 8th, 2018 at the White House. We're talking about the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings with Molly Hemingway, co-author of the new book Justice on Trial. Molly, during this phase of the confirmation hearings, what was happening behind the scenes?
Well, unlike most other presidents and even most other Republican presidents, the Kavanaugh team never worries about the Trump White House pulling out. They know that they're going to stand by them just because of the type of president it is, who the White House counsel is, so they don't have to worry about that. They are extremely worried, and with reason, about whether Republican senators will be able to withstand this last-minute allegation. And in fact, you know, most of what happened was a result of Republican senators wavering. They wavered all the way through to the actual reopening of the hearing. Christine Blasey Ford comes out and gives very emotional, if fact-free, testimony about the allegation. And after that, one of the senators on the Judiciary Committee goes to Susan Collins, another senator whose vote is up for grabs, and says, "How about you and I go to the White House and tell them to pull the nomination and nominate someone else?" And she tells him, "That's not going to happen." She believes in due process and rule of law, and she wants to hear from Kavanaugh before they make any decisions. So she showed some courage that other Republican senators did not.
You actually talk a little bit about kind of cloakroom goings on, the kind of stuff that, wow, you realize that there were a lot of passions involved.
When we first heard about what happened in the ante room to the Judiciary Committee hearing room, it almost seemed like it couldn't possibly happen. We end up interviewing so many people who tell us about this just chaotic scene. So after the hearing, after Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh testified, the next day the Judiciary Committee simply needs to have a vote to get it out of committee so that all the senators can vote on it. And instead what happens is an hours-long complete breakdown of the Judiciary Committee as Senator Flake and Senator Coons are negotiating whether to demand an extra FBI investigation to investigate all of these claims. So they end up being huddled in a tiny phone booth, like a tiny phone booth that really is tiny for one person, but they're both in there together, arms and legs wrapped around each other, trying to call people at the Department of Justice to see if they can get an extra FBI investigation. You have other senators trying to convince one or the other to back off. You have Senator Hatch and some people in the bathroom, in this little tiny room that's off the hearing room. They're calling the American Bar Association, whose president had gone rogue and had, without authority, kind of gone against Kavanaugh, even though the American Bar Association committee that actually is responsible for recommendations strongly endorsed Kavanaugh. And then you have just staffers and senators packed into this room. We describe like one young staffer who gets her foot stepped on by Ted Cruz. Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator from Rhode Island, is like spittling all over her. And one senator almost comes to blow against another because he's so frustrated with Democratic shenanigans that had been going on for weeks. So it just was utter chaos, people fighting, and it ended up being quite fun.
What did you discover about the nature of the FBI investigation?
Well, I think there is a lot of confusion about what an FBI investigation does. It's not like a criminal investigation where you have a crime and that's an established crime and you're determining who committed it. FBI investigations are sort of character evaluations, and they just take information from a lot of different people who know an individual, and then they share that with the committee. So people kept asking and demanding for an additional FBI investigation, but the committee itself had actually already done an investigation. You know, anytime someone would make an allegation, Chairman Grassley and his staff would thoroughly investigate it and report back to the rest of the committee. But in that additional supplemental FBI investigation, it ended up being extremely important because that was where they got information about witness tampering. They realized that there was no further evidence in support of the allegation that Brett Kavanaugh had committed all these crimes. And they also learned that some people close to the situation had reason to doubt the allegation, people who would be in a position to know. So it ends up being very important, and some senators spent quite a few hours going over this FBI investigation and learning. That was also where they learned that there were some people who had different views of the accuser's self-characterization of how she was in high school and whatnot. So it ended up being very helpful to Brett Kavanaugh to have that supplemental investigation.
What are your thoughts on kind of the context of the Me Too movement and this being kind of a blatant grab or a kind of political opportunism? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I think that it's very important that we take sexual assault seriously and that we take abuse by powerful men seriously, and probably nothing hurt the Me Too movement quite so much as its politicization by political operatives who decided to use it to try to destroy a nominee and his chances to be on the Supreme Court. And it was interesting to me, you had recently Jane Mayer, one of the authors of one of the worst pieces about Kavanaugh, just a journalistic travesty, what she wrote. She came out and said that Al Franken was kind of railroaded when people alleged that his unwanted groping and kissing was disqualifying for Senate office, and he was pushed out of his role. She says, well, you know, there's a lot that's wrong with mob mentality and violations of due process. And I'm thinking, yes, there is. You have to balance these things. You want to hold people accountable for their wrongdoing, and you want to make sure that we protect women and children who are victimized sometimes by some powerful men and women for that matter. But you absolutely do not want to do it at the expense of due process, presumption of innocence, and that's true whether it's your political friends or your political opponents. It's a bedrock value that protects us all, and it allows us to put the best construction on everything, protecting alleged victims and alleged assailants.
Does my memory serve correctly, Molly, that there were accusers who later recanted?
Oh, absolutely. There were some who were almost like just caught up in the moment making outlandish claims. And then when the FBI or the Senate Judiciary Committee would interview them, they'd say, oh, my goodness, I was just saying that. One of the outlandish claims that came through Kamala Harris's office was a woman claiming that Brett Kavanaugh and his buddy had assaulted her horrifically in California. And, you know, she wasn't even from California, and she said she'd just kind of, or that there had been a letter that she claimed ownership of, and she just kind of said she got carried away by the moment. Some of the people who made false allegations were referred for criminal prosecution. Nobody has yet been held accountable for making up stories about Brett Kavanaugh.
Will they, do you think?
I worry that they won't. It is somewhat difficult to get people on false statement charges unless you have a powerful multi-year investigation and lots of money and other resources. But I think it's important, if you want to protect the integrity of the process, that people be held accountable for making stuff up and that they not be able to get away with it. That's true of the people making the false allegations. That's true of the senators who willfully violated Senate rules and procedures. It's true of the media who threw out all of their standards to go after Brett Kavanaugh. If there's no accountability for these people, what's the disincentive to do it again?
I imagine this is somewhat of a judgment on your part, but do you believe, given your research, that Christine Ford believes her story?
I certainly think that's possible, and we spoke with many memory experts. Some of what they said really cast doubt on someone like Christine Blasey Ford with her education and how she portrayed her memory. But some kind of pointed out that there are people who convince themselves of something or who have been convinced of something who do not believe that they are lying. I do think, obviously, she made the claim. She doesn't have evidence to support it. There's something going on there, but it's unclear. I will say that we spoke with memory experts who said they chuckled when she said that something was indelible in the hippocampus, like she was irrefutable because she had this memory and it was indelible in the hippocampus. And they said, when it comes to memory, literally nothing is indelible, and there are all sorts of things that, you know, your mind plays tricks on you or you remember things differently than they actually happened. So they thought someone with her background in education actually should have known that.
The picture that was being painted of Brett Kavanaugh in the media was, well, you know, he might be straightened up and fly right now, because they couldn't find anything on him during his professional career with respect to the treatment of women. But, you know, he went through his party phase, and we're just looking back at a high school kid that was doing this. Did you uncover any evidence that he was this kind of crazy man that the media, during his high school years, that the media portrayed him as?
Well, he certainly was, and he actually testified about this. He was someone who drank beer in high school and college, and his friends, you know, all of whom have kind of like continued to be friends with him, attest to that, that they would work really hard. Obviously, he was doing very well in school, both in high school, where he was actively engaged in sports, and getting into Yale, at Yale, where he gets into Yale Law School, and he's still engaged in sports, and then at Yale Law School, where he's doing absolutely stellar work. So he was drinking on weekends, and that is something that he admitted to, and that was something he and his buddies did. When we talked to so many people who knew him from high school, college, and law school, we talked to quite a few ex-girlfriends, and they all say that he treated them with absolute respect. Even, you know, one told a story of having to change clothing in close proximity to him, and he turned around so that she could do that. So very different from the portrayal that you saw in the media of him, you know, if you believed some of these wilder or crazier allegations. The fact that his ex-girlfriends spoke so well of him and continued to have good relationships with him, I think, is also interesting. And also, I think we learned a little bit about why he was able to so categorically deny any of this in that Martha McCallum interview, where he explains that he was not sexually active in high school and college. So these are all parts of the story.
Molly Hemingway is our guest co-author of the new book, Justice on Trial. We're talking about the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. She mentioned earlier attempts to evoke the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill confrontation. We'll find out what that was about after this. If you appreciate Issues Etc., talk radio for the thinking Christian, and Lutheran Public Radio, sacred music for the world, please include a bequest in your will or trust for these worldwide media resources. Bequests aren't subject to federal tax or capital gains taxes. Ensure your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren the opportunity to listen by including a bequest in your will or trust for Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by 2 things: the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us: broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.
Warning, warning, warning.
St. Thomas Choir of Men and Boys with the hymn Holy, 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 playing right now on our 24/7 sacred music station, Lutheran Public Radio. Here's some recent feedback from Christina. She says, it is very nice to listen to sacred music and stay focused on what is most important. I especially enjoy the German language hymns and the British Anglican hymns that you play. They are so peaceful and full of praise to God. Thank you. You can listen to sacred music following the course of the church here anytime, anywhere at LutheranPublicRadio.org and on the LPR mobile app. We're talking about the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings with Molly Hemingway, a Fox News contributor, senior editor at The Federalist, and co-author of the new book, Justice on Trial. Molly, you mentioned earlier attempts on the part of some involved in the process to evoke the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill confrontation. What was that about?
Well, we heard this from quite a few sources, and it almost seemed like too good to be true or too unbelievable, that the Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee were purposely trying to evoke the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings. Those were watched by so many Americans when they happened. It actually like beat out baseball playoff games that were airing at the same time. And they wanted to create parallels so that the media would pick up on them, and they did. And so they had her wear a particular color suit and ask for caffeine, at which point one of the senators gives her coffee, but that wasn't what she wanted. She wanted Coca-Cola, so they bring out a Coke bottle because these were things that were mentioned in the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings. But Mazie Hirono, the senator from Hawaii, actually says to Kamala Harris as they are leaving the Judiciary Committee hearing room and going into that ante room that we talked about before, she says that she really thought that the suit and the Coke can thing went over very well and was happy that they did that. So they were purposely trying to draw parallels to a previous low point of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
There are two moments that are impressed upon my memory as kind of you remember where you were when you saw this happen on TV. One was the Lindsey Graham scolding. Lindsey Graham, I don't think I've ever seen him that passionate. What led up to that?
It was a really remarkable moment, in part because Lindsey Graham is not someone who you associate with this type of outburst. But it is important to note that that day had been one of the most emotional days ever in the Senate. It begins with hours of testimony from Christine Blasey Ford, which many people on the left found emotionally compelling. Then you have Brett Kavanaugh's defense of his name, honor, reputation, in a lengthy 40-plus minute opening remarks, and then he's being questioned by Rachel Mitchell. And then by the time Lindsey Graham speaks, it is the first time anyone has defended Kavanaugh since Charles Grassley introduced both him and Christine Blasey Ford and had a few nice remarks about each of them hours earlier. The country was watching, and they were so pained by what they had seen. And you had a media that was, at every break, they would come in and they would praise Christine Blasey Ford, and they would say that Republicans had no plan for Kavanaugh. So by the time Graham speaks, it was just very cathartic for everybody to have someone make a defense for what this man had gone through, and it ends up being quite the turning point for that day.
The other moment, of course, is Kavanaugh's impassioned defense. I'm watching it, and I'm thinking, a guy who knows in the back of his mind that he did what he was accused of could not generate the kind of raw emotion that was evidence in his defense. What were your thoughts?
Well, it was interesting to interview so many people, and many of the men that we interviewed would say, well, please don't mention this, but that brought me to tears. And it was just funny because it was so many of the men that we interviewed who were saying they had emotional reactions to Kavanaugh's testimony, but they all felt like they didn't want people to know that they were crying as they watched it. I have a friend who's been falsely accused of something, and I went through that with him a couple of years ago, and he said that when he watched it, he just felt such compassion for him and what he was going through. It was almost an impossible task to prove that he hadn't done it, yet he somehow managed to come out after this compelling performance from Christine Blasey Ford, or compelling testimony. They were compelling to a lot of people in the media, I should say. I don't think it was as compelling to many people at home. And be able to defend himself, it really was a remarkable turnaround when just, moments earlier, the media had said it is over for him. There is no way he can make it through the day.
So what do you know, have you discovered about the effect on the Kavanaugh family?
Well, I think that we have learned that in many ways they came through it fine. They found their marriage to be strengthened. They found their faith to be strengthened. And I remember talking to someone immediately after he was confirmed, someone who knew him, who said, for better or for worse, this will not change him as a judge at all. He will be the same judge he always was. And I think that's definitely true. After a full term on the court, you see him behaving exactly as he did the previous 12 years on the federal court. But it would be impossible to go through something like this without having some effect. But it looks like they made it through fine. They're continuing to live their lives, and they have received a lot of support from friends, including, you know, neighbors who don't agree with them politically, but who knew that what happened was just a travesty.
Does a cloud hang over his term as justice?
Well, it does, only because people, you know, this is why I think it's important to get the facts out about what evidence there was to support the claim that he was a rampant sexual abuser. There's not actually evidence to support any of it, but you see people still mention it. I mentioned the Jane Mayer article where she defends Al Franken, and she quotes someone saying, well, what Al Franken did, it wasn't like, you know, what Brett Kavanaugh did. It's like, well, that's true in that there's no evidence Brett Kavanaugh even met his chief accuser, much less that he assaulted her, whereas you have, you know, for better or for worse, you have actual photographic evidence of some of what the women were claiming they didn't like about Al Franken. I'm not saying that he should have been railroaded either. I'm a strong believer in giving people the chance to defend themselves, but to have that every time his name is mentioned, I think that does pain him that his daughters will have to see that for the rest of their lives.
You've done a lot of interviews on your book. Is there a question that you haven't been asked and wanted to answer?
Oh, I don't know. That's a really, that's a good question. No, I don't know. It's been quite the experience to go through it and to have such a great response to it, too. When Carrie and I wrote it, we gave up a lot of time, and she and I both are, you know, we have young children and husbands who had to deal with much time away from us. But we are absolutely thrilled at how well people are responding to it, how much people are responding to it, and they send in interesting questions or notes or additional information. So it's great to get that kind of feedback from so many people.
So why do you think it's gotten this kind of reaction?
I think people were horrified, not just that this happened to a particular man, but that so many people who you would expect to know better were just casting out presumption of innocence as an ideal that we should hold to, or rule of law, or, you know, due process. It was terrifying to watch people, you know, senators and people in the media who should know better, just deciding that there would be no downside if we convict people based on emotions as opposed to evidence, and not even particularly, for many people, not particularly compelling emotions. And I think that it was the most important thing to happen to the country last year, probably, and the way the media just kind of moved on the moment it was over and pretended that all that time they demanded to investigate these complaints, you know, that they would just move on as if nothing had happened, I think was scarring to a lot of people.
How do you account for that? The media's almost immediate amnesia.
Well, I would only say that if they thought it was so bad to risk a guy getting on the Supreme Court who might have this in the background, it's certainly worse if he's actually on the court. And so the lack of investigation and the lack of updates on the investigation really, you know, makes their behavior during the confirmation process seem more partisan than earnest. And I think that they also started to realize at some point this was a not unwise Democratic plan to delay and obstruct this nomination in the hopes that maybe they could take back the Senate and be able to stop any Trump nominee. And when they started to realize that not only was that not working, it was actually invigorating Republican voters, they were starting to say they were more interested in voting, and they hadn't been that interested after 2 years of what they'd experienced the Senate and House doing. They started to back off, I think, because they realized it was backfiring in a big way.
Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor, senior editor at The Federalist, and co-author of the new book, Justice on Trial. When you purchase Justice on Trial using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click On Demand Archives, and look for Justice on Trial. Molly, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Emily Gao of the Heritage Foundation about the U.S. State Department's emphasis on religious liberty, and we'll discuss Mary Magdalene with Rebecca Curtis, co-author of the book Ladylike Living Biblically. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the divine service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. thecleaningauthority.com.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.